and welcome to Quarter Time Podcast. I'm Lucy G.
And I'm Lucy P.
And we're here to bring you all the netball goodness you never knew you needed. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to episode 11. Last weekend was our second bye week from the Vitality Netball Super League, but fortunately the netball gods were smiling on us and the stars aligned, meaning that this weekend just so happened to be the opening round of the ANZ Premiership in New Zealand. So on today's show, we're going to mix things up a little bit as we take a look at all the action from round one.
Coming up, we've got our usual three-word summaries for each clash, and then we'll be moving on to a new section where we'll name our quarter-time trio. These are the three players that stood out for us this week in each area of the court. Then we'll reveal our matchups of the round before moving on to our special guest interview.
This week, we're chatting with Daniel Lavapour, who is London Pulse's strength and conditioning coach, about all things, surprise, surprise, strength and conditioning. Dan has been the S&C coach for the Silver Ferns and the Northern Mystics, and we'll be asking him about how to build a positive and productive training environment, as well as what the future holds for S&C within the Super League.
Amazing. Let's get straight into it with our review of the opening round of the ANZ. What were your thoughts on the weekend, Lucy G?
Oh man, it was so good to watch the ANZ again. I got super hooked last year and I've been really, really excited for it to start again. I thought there was really great quality netball. There was, you know, one blowout game, but even then it was still really high quality, I thought, and very, very watchable. The number of player movements from 2020 into 2021 is insane. And I think it's really going to shake up the competition. In fact, I think we've seen that already.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was really interesting to see all those big movers and who did and who didn't have an impact. For me, Gina Crampton's move to Stars was huge. I think she was exactly what they were missing. And obviously we've got that new look magic shooting end as well. I will say I was expecting a bit more from Karen Berger since her move to the Tactics, but I think she'll grow as we go through the season. What actually was really interesting for me was that the three top teams from last season all lost this weekend in the opening round. So that just kind of demonstrates how close the competition is in the ANZ and how tight it really is at the top.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a cracking season. And, you know, it's anyone's game this year, I think. So, yeah, cannot wait for more rounds. So let's kick off with our three-word summaries. Take it away, Luce.
So the first game was Pulse versus Stars. And for this one, I said, muscle up, baby. What a way to start off the season, with the Northern Stars taking a narrow win against last year's champions. The Pulse were looking a little bit depleted without Ekinasio in goal attack and Rore in goal defence, and they trailed for the entire game. Contact penalties were even and fairly high, to be honest, 43 to Pulse and 44 to Stars, and there was a lot of body on body, with both sides getting pretty willing. We'll actually touch on this a bit later on in our talking point.
Yeah, great game. Second game was Tactics versus Steel, and I've gone for Steely-Eyed Showdown. This was an outstanding performance by the Steel, who looked in complete control from quarter two onwards. Tactics centre pass to goal percentage was just 57%, and they were the only team in round one not to convert over 70% of their centre passes, which could be a bit of a worrying sign for them this season, who knows. Fifita and Selby Rickett were all over the Tactics attacking line and caused a lot of disruption.
Finally, we had Mystics versus Magic, and for this one I said, welcome, Caitlin Bassett.
Yes.
What an amazing performance by the Magic, with a brand new shooting duo of Seabass and Chiara Semple, who were absolutely bossing it. They look like they've been playing together for years. It was amazing. Magic converted 100% of their gains to goal in this game, compared to the Mystics 67. Wowza. Mystics looked a bit uncomfortable at points, and they really struggled to settle their attacking end. There were just numerous balls just being lobbed over the baseline. It was a cracking game though, and great for Mystics to keep the score within five, meaning they will earn themselves a valuable bonus point. Moving on to our quarter time trio. How exciting. Lucy G, take it away. You've got Attack.
So, yes, in the attack and end, I mean, in my mind, there is no one that could take this away from our very own George Fisher. Yes. Oh my God, what a debut. I, you know, I've never even met her. I don't know her at all, but I feel so proud of her. Is that really silly? I don't know. But you could just see she was having the absolute time of her life with that smile. And, you know, in the post-match interview, it was incredible. And she was absolutely not fazed by the competition. Mm-hmm. Whatsoever. And bear in mind, she was up against two current silver ferns, two of the best in the game in the world. Mm. And it was just like, you know, standard Wednesday morning at the office. Like, it was absolutely no skin off her nose whatsoever. She shot 46 of 49 at 94%, taking the vast majority of the shooting load, as Maturo didn't really have a great day at the post. So yeah, she just absolutely killed it. Good for you, George, if you're listening.
Yeah, hands down. She was amazing, wasn't she? I actually thought she was pretty much robbed of player of the match during this game.
Right? Oh my God.
Considering it was her debut in the ANZ. But the test for me will really be how she comes out this weekend. So if she can replicate that kind of performance, or if the pressure, now that people know what to expect from her a bit more, they know what they're going to be up against. We'll just have to wait and see how she goes.
So in the midcourt, who have we got, Luce?
So we have got Gina Crampton.
Nice.
I thought she was outstanding this week. She had an incredible game, and she was the top feeder actually in the game with 40 feeds. Insane. Wow. And the next highest was 28. She also had the highest number of goal assists with 26, the next highest being 18. Wow, she was a force in this game. And what I was particularly impressed by was her connection with Maya Wilson, which is definitely going to be a key combination in terms of the Silver Ferns moving forward. Crampton is just super calm with the ball. She only had one general play turnover in this whole game. She's also such a workhorse, second most centre pass receives in this game as well. But another thing I was impressed with was just her control and patience. She's just got this perfect, like, Goldilocks blend of speed and control. I just love watching her. She was awesome.
Yeah, she was an absolute standout. And I think, you know, bear in mind that you've got Monica Faulkner in goal attack as well at times. That's, you know, that's potentially half of your Silver Ferns lineup there. Like, it's, danger signs for the rest of the world.
Yeah, and there were a lot of really good midquarters this week that I thought really stood up. You know, Claire Kirsten was another one.
Sam Winders.
Yeah, Sam Winders. So yeah, hotly contested, and I think Crampton pulled it out the bag.
So rounding off the trio in defence, I've gone for Anna Harrison. Mate, I definitely need to watch some old school matches to see some more of Harrison, because if she's playing like this now, having come out of retirement again, then she must have been an absolute weapon back in the day.
Yeah.
Did you know she's a triple code athlete? I had no idea. She does beach volleyball, indoor volleyball, and netball. I just think that's so mental. How can one person be so talented? And get this, she actually trialed as a shooter for the Shore Rovers Club last year.
What?
I was like, there's literally nothing she can't do. She gives me real Jane Watson vibes with, like, the arms flailing everywhere. She reminds me, in the nicest possible way, of one of those inflatable men outside of a car wash. She's just absolutely everywhere, such a menace, and it was incredible to watch her.
Yeah, I think you should probably say that Jane Watson gives you Anna Harrison vibes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, she was awesome, wasn't she? I just love watching her, and I couldn't believe how fit she looks. Like, you can't tell that she's been having some time away from netball at all. I thought she was incredible. I thought she was such a hassler. And when she moved back into goalkeeper, it really just allowed her to read the game as well a bit more. And yeah, she was just a brick wall. I mean, you're not getting anything past her. She was amazing. Moving on to our matchup of the round. So I'll go first. A big contender for matchup of the round for me was actually the Mystics attack versus the goalpost. they had several misses in the opening quarter, and it actually turned out that the post was wonky. Did you see that?
Mental.
Yeah, and that everyone had to stop playing for them to sort it out. I'd never seen that before. It was very, very amusing. But seriously, my matchup of the round was also from that game. It was Sulu Fitzpatrick on Caitlin Bassett. I loved watching these two battle it out for the first three quarters of the game, and then I think Sulu moved to goal defense in the last quarter. But I just think they really worked each other out throughout the game, and Sulu was getting Bassett on the move a little bit. But wow, you really just cannot underestimate the power of Seabass when she gets her hold on under the post, and particularly on the rebound. She had 8 rebounds in this game, which is amazing. Wow. And just for me, both players are obviously fairly senior in terms of experience, and I just love seeing this kind of battle as it makes for such a good spectacle. Sulu had 5 games and 2 intercepts, and Bassett shot 36 from 41 at 88%. So yeah, fantastic day at the office for both.
Yeah, this is a brilliant pick. And I have to say, the thing that really stood out for me in this game was seeing how happy Seabass was. And you could just see like the joy radiating off of her and how she was encouraging her goal attacks. It was just joyful to see the shooter that we've all known and love over the years in the Aussie Diamonds and obviously in SSN, to see her properly back in action and somewhere that she feels valued. I think that was really special to see.
Yeah, 100%.
So for my matchup, I'm moving into the midcourt, and I've gone for Claire Kirsten and Mila Rulu Buchanan. I thought these two were a brilliant matchup, and there really wasn't much to separate them at all in terms of stats. They had very similar number of feeds, similar number of goal assists, etc. The only key differences for me were that Kirsten had over double the number of general play turnovers than Mila.
Wow.
And Mila had double the number of penalties. But overall, I think they balanced each other out really nicely. These two are absolutely rapid and are seriously competitive, feisty players, which you just love to see. I think as well, given that Kirsten has almost a decade on Buchanan, I think they match up really, really well.
Yeah, I kind of love that when you have two really spicy centres and they almost cancel each other out, because they're both just like, you know, one will get a win in this quarter and then the other will come back at them. Yeah, I loved watching this matchup. It was really, really good.
Okay, moving on to our talking point this week. I think everyone could probably take a guess at what it's going to be this week.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about that clip of Maya Wilson. Oh, for anyone who hasn't seen it, head over to our Twitter page at Quarter Time Pod and check it out, because it really is something. Just to summarize it, Paris Mason, brilliant young defender, came on in the third quarter in goalkeeper, and from the off she was doing a really amazing job putting tons of pressure on Maya, and you could see that she was quite visibly having an impact on her. You know, Maya missed quite a few easy shots by her standards at least, and was clearly a bit rattled by Mason's presence. And then as the ball was making its way down court, Maya literally shoved Mason by the face across the other side of the court. And I cannot tell you how many times I've watched this clip now, but what I can tell you is that the only time I've ever seen anything like this really is in rugby.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking, wasn't it? To the face as well. I think it's something to do with, like, if it's a bit of a shoulder, like you see them, a bit of an elbow in here and there, you know, everyone sort of pretty much does that at this level. But to the face was something that I haven't really seen before either. Although I did watch it and I thought that maybe she was, Paris Mason was maybe holding Maya's arm, and I think she was almost getting her arm out from like a lock where it was being held down at her side. So it's difficult because we won't really know what happens. I think you'd have to get another camera angle in there to really see what actually happened, but it did not look good, and it wasn't a good look for pretty much the starting Silver Ferns goal shooter to be behaving like that.
And the Stars captain, don't forget. I think you're right. I think Mason was sort of holding onto her arm, but you see that all the time. Like, that's not something new. That's not something that's particularly outrageous, although probably really annoying for shooters. It's the fact that it was directed towards the face that got me. You know, she could have pushed the arm, she could have pushed the body, but it was like in the face. And I think she might have actually caught her in the eye. But for me, this brings up a really interesting question, which they actually referenced in commentary at the time, is whether netball should have a judiciary panel that can review serious incidents like this and then discipline players after the fact. I personally do think this would be a good idea. Depending on details of how it would work, that would be really key. And I think that this particular incident would absolutely be something that is serious enough to be included in that. And this would ensure that the physicality of the game, which we talk about all the time, doesn't escalate to levels that are unacceptable or unsporting. There was also a moment actually with Maddie Gordon, who practically clotheslined one of the Stars' midquarters. I can't remember who it was now. And luckily it wasn't a serious injury, but she came away from that without so much as a caution. And honestly, I think if that had been VNSL, I reckon she'd have easily come away with a warning.
Yeah, I think it needs something, doesn't it, to really look back and standardize that process, because umpires have to make a decision in just a split second in the moment about what did that actually look like. Mm-hmm. But now the game is getting more physical. We need to be able to review and, you know, take a step back and say, okay, well, what was going on? And also see when maybe the umpires have called things unfairly. Like we say a lot of times, oh, you know, that looked quite soft, you know, from where we're sitting. But maybe if we had a bit more of that review process, it would just really standardize it. And I think in comparison with the VNSL, I think there's a lot more physicality in the ANZ compared with the Super League. I think as well, it's interesting because of this whole debate we have about contact and contest. And sometimes you probably do need to look at things afterwards to really see, you know, when we can see on that clip, that video, it's very obvious what's happening. But in the moment, you know, the umpire might have missed it. I don't think there was even a penalty for Maya Wilson after that incident, which is crazy. And then you think about other things that have happened, for example, LaTanya Wilson being sent off that time, do you remember, in the Super League, and whether we could review things like that to see, you know, whether different action needed to be taken at the time. But I guess also it's about what action would be taken. You know, are you going to ban players from a game? Are you going to deduct points from the team? You know, how would that work if you're reviewing it after the fact? I think there's a whole load of questions you'd need to ask about what the punishments would be and how it would be sorted out.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I think this is a really interesting thing. And I think it's something that, as we get more physical, we potentially need. So it'd be great to hear your thoughts, our lovely listeners, on whether you think this is something that is necessary for netball moving forwards, and how you think this could be rolled out and managed. So yeah, get in touch on social media.
Coming up next, we chat to the strength and conditioning coach of London Pulse and the founder of Performance Ready, Dan Lavapour, about all things strength and conditioning within netball.
We are so pleased to be joined by strength and conditioning legend, Daniel Lavapour. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much for having me, girls.
Absolute pleasure. How are you finding the Super League? Been nice having a bye week, and obviously we're now in London.
Yeah, well, look, it's been good, although our results, as you guys will know, haven't been exactly what we wanted. We're 2 from 10, but the girls are training really well. And like you mentioned, we're on a bye week at the moment, which means there's more scope to train. You know, of course, when you have a game every weekend, somewhat of the week is based around recovering. So, you know, at the moment we can train quite hard and then obviously taper off before our next game against Surrey on Monday.
Amazing. That's going to be such a good one. That was actually, I think, one of the closest scores that we've had so far, wasn't it? 42-40. So I think that's going to be a great matchup.
Yeah, I hope so. I think that, you know, that hurt for me a little bit, and, you know, the players even more so being on the court, but a very close game, and hopefully we take it next time.
Yeah. So cracking on, for those of our listeners who don't know, you've been a strength and conditioning coach for many years now, working with the likes of Northern Mystics, the Silver Ferns, and of course, more recently, London Pulse. So can you talk us through briefly how you came to work within netball specifically?
Yeah, good question. And this goes back to, I think it was 2008, and I just finished my sports science degree at Liverpool John Moores. And, you know, I was interning and trying to start a strength and conditioning career. And it wasn't really taken off in terms of paid work. You know, I was doing lots of volunteering and interning and stuff like that, but I wasn't getting that role. And I had some advice that if you can't be paid here, you may as well not be paid somewhere else. So I had this great idea just to go to the other side of the world, to New Zealand, and kind of see what would happen, a kind of like going for the land of opportunity kind of thing. So I had a relationship with a professor there at one of the universities that we built up over a number of months. And he invited me out there to come hang out and look for some funding for some research that we could do, which would be my master's. And the funding we found was from Netball New Zealand. And, you know, they asked at the time, what do you know about netball? And, you know, is this something you're interested in? And I'd helped out a few of the university netballers in Liverpool, but, you know, I didn't really know much about the sport. In fact, I went to that first meeting, you know, Googling what the positions were and, you know, the positions and stuff like that. But we found this funding to do some research in terms of jump landings in elite netballers. And as you guys know, you know, jump landings, they're the highest injury risk for us within the sport. And we wanted to investigate how the netballers land and how they land affects their incidence of injury and how you can mitigate some of those things. So I started doing this research in 2008, and that put me into this world of netball. You know, I'm hanging out with, you know, coaches in the national programs, you know, having cool conversations with various people. And I'm starting to train some young netballers as well, you know, in different local teams. And within that first year, I was lucky enough to come across a lady called Lynn Gunson, who led a lot of the English players actually over at Bath. You might be aware of who she is. And we got on really well. And she thought I'd be great for a job at the Mystics for the following season, which was now takes us to 2010. She gave me this intro to it. I started working with them. And then I spent 3 years with the Mystics, 4 years with the Silver Ferns based out of the Auckland region. And I was lucky enough to travel with them to the Fastnet World Champs in Liverpool, which New Zealand won. And then from there, I came back to the UK, left netball for a little bit. And then London Pulse had just started. I made contact with the coach at the time, was Amanda Newton, who you guys will know well as well. And she you know, offered me something to do there. And I think that was 4 years ago now.
Amazing. And so you've mentioned briefly you took a bit of a break from netball, and I know that you've worked within athletics, with runners, and also with the FA, I believe. So what is it, in your opinion, about netball that sets it apart from these other sports? Because we all know it's a superior sport, let's be honest.
Netball's a great sport to work in as a strength and conditioning coach. You know, the coaches and the, you know, the rest of the, you know, the high performance staff and the environment you're in really embraces strength and conditioning in a way that not every other sport does. You know, I do work with the FA and in football, and one of our challenges in terms of, you know, working with the players there is you have to kind of get after a lot more buy-in. You have to kind of sell a lot more of what you're trying to do to the clubs to get the players to train in a certain way. But for whatever reason, netball and netball coaches, they bought in already. And the question is more about, you know, what can you do and how well you can do it, as opposed to can you do anything? So, you know, the point I'm trying to make here is there's fantastic scope to really try and influence performance as a strength and conditioning coach within the sport. And there's some cool quirks to it too. You know, obviously the two-step rule, you know, that means business is good for injuries, and strength and conditioning coaches are in the business of trying to prevent injuries. So, you know, there's a ton to play with there. And also, you know, physical prep really influences the game. You know, our fittest, strongest, fastest players, you know, have these physical skills which can massively swing games, and you guys will have seen it, you know, in every game you watch.
And how much differentiation is there between the training for different positions, so the sort of programs that you would give a defender versus a shooter, mid-quarter, etc.?
Yeah, great question. Some, but then also a lot of it is very similar. You know, whether you're a GK or a center, you know, you still have two arms, two legs, heart, lung, and you know, the human body can only move in certain ways. So a lot of it is very similar. I probably base it more around the athlete than their position now. And you guys will know, you know, pick any position, you know, maybe, you know, a goal shoot's a good example of this, because you probably see more difference in the type of shooters. And let's include the GA in that as well. You see more difference across the GSGA than you might see with the centers, right? You know, the GSGA, they're playing a similar position, but they're very different. And so you bias the training more around who they are as individuals, as opposed to what the position requires. You know, some of the differences you would see, you know, tall versus a little shorter, right? You know, how do they move? Can they move it in unique ways, or do they bring a certain style of play to the game that requires a certain difference in their type of training. You know, the other one as well is that not all netballers are runners, right? So when it comes to the conditioning, you know, you can't get a GK to run the same as you would a centre. It's not so much because of the position, but because of how they're put together. And actually with our team, you know, our GSs, they can really run. So I train them more like centres in some way than some of the other goal shooters I've worked with at other teams.
That's really interesting. And speaking about this physicality that you've referenced, we've obviously had a lot of talk about physicality this year in the VNSL. One of the standout moments for me was the Pulse versus Stars game, where Melissa Bessel said in the post-match interview that she just wanted to go home and have a cuppa, and rather indirectly said that Pulse's physicality on court was, you know, borderline unacceptable. So as Pulse's strength and conditioning coach, what were your thoughts on that post-match interview?
Yeah, you know, I actually don't remember seeing, I don't remember hearing that at the time. Yeah, for whatever reason, that hasn't sat in my memory. But look, let's, rather than talk about that one comment, let's talk about the game. You know, it's supposedly non-contact. We all know, you know, in some games, you know, you're either on the bad end of that physicality, or maybe, you know, the opposition feels that you were driving that stuff a little bit more. Look, all I can say as a strength and conditioning coach is our job to prepare the players, not to, you know, rough it out on the court, but to handle the physical demands of the game. And, you know, it's always in the back of my mind that these players are contacting each other. And I'm not trying to give them the skills to go out and have the type of contact on the court that goes beyond the rules of the game. In fact, we never even reference those things. But they have to be able to withstand having someone on their shoulder and their hip. And we consider how that, you know, application of force might affect their movement, and therefore they need to be stronger and more controlled in how they can kind of stabilize against those contacts. So sorry, I know that doesn't answer your question around that specific moment, but I hope that gives you an understanding of what I'm thinking about there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, they alluded it as well in the post-match discussions around preparing teams for the international game. And I actually would question whether it was a case, you know, Pulse weren't too physical, whether Stars weren't physical enough, and whether they don't have the same level or the same intensity of training as Pulse do. So I think that just highlighted maybe some disparities there. So looking at that physicality from an international perspective, when you think of bigger competitions like the World Cup, Comm Games, international fixtures, the loading of athletes is so intense, and it just gets greater and greater the further into the competition they go, which obviously culminates in finals when their bodies have just been beaten and battered almost every day for 2 weeks or so. So how do you prepare athletes for this level of sustained intensity? You know, should the VNSL keep doing double headers to prepare athletes for the international stage in that way?
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting question. Look, if you're preparing someone for a marathon, what you don't do is run a marathon every week. You know, you don't have to replicate the demands of a Netball World Cup or Commonwealth Games in the domestic season to prepare the athletes for that. It's not that you don't need that same exposure. But what you do need is strong, resilient bodies that can handle the demands of the game. And like you alluded to, the games are clustered closer together in a Commonwealth Games and World Champs. You know, you're playing every 3 or 4 days, depending on how the draws, maybe even every 2 days. It's not the exposure to the game in the domestic season which is going to do that. It's a strong body that can handle the forces and can recover well enough and fast enough between those games. So whilst it will be good for the players to experience the double headers and they can take that feeling through, you know, what all the players need to remember within the domestic season is to keep training between those weeks. You know, what you don't want to do is just play on the Saturday and then spend the week doing technical and recovery work, getting ready for the next Saturday, because, you know, forget about the Commonwealth Games World Champs. You know, as the season goes on, you're just going to get a kind of breakdown of the tissue, and you're going to experience this drop in resilience that means you might not even last the domestic season, let alone handle the international competition.
I suppose as well, you know, building the strength and being able to see out the season, we know that netball is a really difficult sport on the body, to say the least. And when it comes to injuries, according to the Netball Australia National Assurance data, 25% of major injuries reported from netball involve a rupture of the ACL. And oh my God, it just breaks my heart every time you see a player go down and you hear that scream, you know exactly what it is. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And of course, we saw that happen to Beth and Dyke just a few weeks ago. I'm assuming part of an S&C program is based on injury prevention. So how much time is spent on this in BNSL and in training, and what kind of things go into injury prevention?
Yeah, and look, the longer you are involved in strength and conditioning for any sport, the more you realize it's almost all about injury prevention and performance comes second. You know, probably the misconception is that strength training and strength and conditioning is all about, you know, jumping higher and running faster. The main thing you're trying to do is get the players to handle the demands of the game and handle the intensity of the training and the frequency of those sessions. And the more resilient you can get those players to handling those demands I just described, that the more technical practice you can do and the better you can become that way. Now, early on in a player's career, you can bias the training a little bit more to jumping higher and, you know, being faster. But after a certain point, you know, it's really diminishing returns. You know, a human body can only jump so high, right? So let's say you get a player to jump 45 centimeters, 50 centimeters. They're not going to get much more than that, right? So from that point, it's about teaching them to handle the demands of what's happening in training. And so everything you do is that, you know, when they're squatting or lunging or whatever task you're getting them to do in the gym, it's how well are they doing it? Are they loading each joint in the way that that joint likes to be loaded? And you gave the example of the ACL. Well, that's in the knee. And if anyone just kind of wiggles their knee up and down as they're moving to this, the knee only likes to move in one way. You know, it likes to extend. It doesn't go sideways. And, you know, when it does, something's going to go. And, you know, sadly, like you described, the ACL is probably not built for purpose. And, you know, without getting too gory here, I've been to a human dissection and looked at, you know, looked inside the knee, and you see the limited capacity of the structures within the knee to handle some of these forces. And because of the two-step rule in netball, you know, we're at a big, big risk of getting hurt. And look, if our players aren't healthy and if they're hurt, well, they can't do anything on the court. So look, number one priority, keep them healthy, keep them on the court, and give them the chance to do what they do best.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly didn't realize, you know, the bulk of it is around injury prevention rather than building strength, jumping higher, jumping faster. That's really interesting. And how do you balance the, you know, the technical training, the fitness training, the injury prevention, the strength building, when you only have the athletes for a small number of hours per week because it's not a fully professional sport? How do you balance that?
Well, firstly, you've got to take the time to understand each athlete. And you can do that by profiling them, you know, in you know, specific assessments. But also, just as a group of coaches, you're always watching them. And everything they do is a test. So you're trying to understand each athlete at a deeper level so that when you decide what to give them, you give them what they really need. The other thing you're trying to do is understand what they can tolerate through the, you know, through the cycling of the training through the week. Right now, we're all motivated. We all want to do more training. But the sad reality is you just can't, you know, run yourself into the ground every day. You can't jump every day. So you have this kind of week that you might start with, and then you just see by looking at the athletes, can they handle more? You know, we want to do more speed work. Do we think they can handle it? And you might try it, but, you know, maybe they complain about too much soreness. You see other elements of the training are starting to drop, but then you kind of sit back and say, okay, you know, that was too much speed work that week. Maybe we need to give them, you know, whatever it is. So combination of assessment, trial and error, listening to the athletes, you know, you have to speak to them every day. How are you feeling? What's sore? That's probably the first question I say to everyone every day. How's the body? You know, how's the knees, the ankles? How's the back? You know, how's your problem area? And listen to them and don't push them where they can't be pushed. Be really responsive to those answers.
The thing that I find with strength and conditioning, and certainly when I did my very small number of sessions with you, is that it's not something that you necessarily see instant results in. It's something that very much builds over time. And I was reading an article on growth culture in the Harvard Business Review, of all places, and it made me think of strength and conditioning training and how, you know, in my opinion, as an observer, the same principles apply in business as they do here. So the principles were, number one, building an environment that feels safe. Number two, a focus on continuous learning. Number three, time-limited manageable experiments. And number four, continuous feedback. All of these things feed into building a culture of growth rather than a performance-driven culture. So how important is growth mindset in strength and conditioning over a solely physical ability?
Yeah, I love those 4 points you've just given, and please give them to me after the podcast. I'm going to steal them and put them in, you know, every presentation I do from here on. But growth mindset, super important. And the way you describe those four things, I think really, you know, underpins the way to achieve it. You know, firstly, having an environment where the players want to turn up, want to train hard, and, you know, want to be better. You know, fill that with the idea of learning. You know, it's not just about clinically doing what you need to do to be better. And I think that's strength and conditioning at its worst, when it's almost like a medicinal approach. You know, take two of these pills and see you in the morning. And you know, strength training shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't be do your squats and you're going to be better. It's about what can you learn, you know, firstly about your own body, you know, how you move, learn about yourself and your character and how that can go to the game through the training as well, and learn how to be a better athlete. Mm. And look, one of the great things about strength and conditioning compared to, you know, being on the court, because you have to take lots of rest within the weight room, there's loads of time to talk. And, you know, we probably do more talking than training. So, you know, you really get into some cool stuff. And, you know, I'm not saying the whole time we're in the gym, it's very serious conversations. In fact, it's probably like 95%, you know, talking rubbish and the music's going and all that. But that 5% of those conversations that you have, you know, they can be really powerful. And, you know, if there's any coaches listening to this podcast, you know, the more you can pass your team's message on to your strength and conditioning coach and other support staff, you know, they have, you know, a great ability to make those messages live in the weight room through those conversations. And, you know, to relate it back to growth mindset, like you said, if that's part of your team's thing, you know, and what the team needs to do, the S&C coach can have a big role in trying to, you know, change the brains of some of these players in that particular direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like you say, there's so much more to it than just the physical. And when I was actually reading your blog, I came across a really great quote from Amar Egbezi. She said, "Training isn't just about improving your speed. It's more about getting your body to perform at the highest level. It's really difficult to batter your body day in, day out. You're actually just training to make sure your body doesn't break down when you push it to its limits." So all of that training and exertion on the body must be so demanding on athletes mentally as well. So thinking about that link between physical well-being and mental well-being, how much of a person's physical strength and conditioning is centered around their mental strength and condition?
Yeah, look, if the mind is not in the place to train, you know, we're not training. And, you know, your job as a coach in any domain, you know, we're talking about strength and conditioning, but in any domain, it's like you said before, create an environment where the player wants to be better and enjoys being there and sees the value in what you're doing. So, you know, what I try and do is, you know, use a certain language around the exercises and the sessions that we're doing that the player buys into and they get. And that language might change depending on who you are. Like, you know, I was inspired by Rocky movies, and every time I train, I want, you know, Eye of the Tiger going, and, you know, the coach Mickey next to me shouting, you know, you can do it, and all, you know, crazy buzz friends. But not everyone likes that. You know, some people like to be left alone, headphones in, and, you know, do their thing. So, you know, it's about being respectful to, you know, how they want to train and trying to figure that out. And sometimes you get it wrong, but, you know, you figure it out quite quickly because, you know, it's quite apparent that you've gone down the wrong. Yeah, and look, also you have to you have to counter the intensity of the game and the intensity of the experience with the opposite sometimes. And sometimes that's your role, you know, with strength and conditioning as well. If you feel that players are just battered mentally from what's happened on the court, you know, a defeat or a very technical practice, well, maybe, you know, we're not going to compete in the gym that day, or, you know, I'm not going to give you over technical feedback. In fact, look, one of the sessions we're doing at the moment, I'm letting the girls choose the exercises they do within a framework that I've given. So now it's, you know, not, they don't have to conform or kind of find their way through what I've programmed. It's now, what do you want to do? What feels right for your body and your headspace on that given day? And I've given them the parameters so that we know we're not going to overload them or anything like that. But, you know, that ownership is a nice counter to the intensity and, you know, the technical challenge of what's happening on the court right now.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I think as well, when you consider the fact that netball is a predominantly female sport as well, and we have things, you know, like our menstrual cycle, where we can feel certain things at different times of the month, you know, it impacts us from our mood to our appetite to our sleeping, our ability to concentrate, but also our ability to exercise and work out, and having to have a grasp of where each individual person is at that moment in the month is really important. And what I loved in, I was reading an article in 2019, the players of Chelsea Women's Football Club actually synced their training regimes with their menstrual cycle to aid their performance at those different times of the month. So given that netball is predominantly a women's sport, how much consideration goes into the menstrual cycle specifically within the planning of netball sessions in your experience? Or is this an area of real growth for the sport?
Yeah, look, it's probably an area that I'm not qualified to get into at, you know, a deeper level. But I would say that how, you know, I consider this area is similar to how I consider the rest of the training, is that it's responsive to, you know, how the athlete's feeling and able to train on any given day. And that what's written down on the program isn't the Bible and doesn't have to be how it is on that day. And if an athlete can or can't handle it, you know, we can shift that training in different ways. And, you know, you're right, this is becoming an area that's more understood and more talked about and more considered than it ever has. And it has to be that way. You know, and for any other issue that impacts any athlete in any way, we have to consider all these things. And you know, it's fantastic that this stuff is being better understood right now.
Yeah, I find it fascinating because when I was doing some research on this, there is some research done, but there's not a huge amount. And the results tend to be quite conflicting. Like, some of the studies say that, yes, there are certain activities that you'll likely perform worse in at certain times of the month. And then other studies say, you know, no, there's not really any correlation. So I just find it baffling how we're in 2021 and we still don't have like a wealth of data, bearing in mind that we're half the population. Yeah, it does seem to be like a lot of room for growth in this area, seeing as it does, or it can impact us so immensely.
Yeah, and look, kind of echoing, you know, what you've just said, it was great to see at the support staff and coaches conference prior to the start of the Super League season last year. You know, we didn't have one this year because of the pandemic. Before, one of the two keynote presentations was on this area. And, you know, we had Britain's top expert on it talk to us about it. We all went away with a wealth of information and really practical information that we can use. So, yeah, you're right. It's surprising that it's maybe not more at the fore, but I was very grateful to be exposed to some of the best research and information on it through netball and through my role at Pulse.
Thinking about you specifically as a coach, obviously I've done a small number of sessions with you and I absolutely loved them. And the thing that I found most appealing about your sessions were how accessible they were, whether you're an absolute novice like me who has no sort of strength or conditioning whatsoever to, you know, Olympic athletes. And we had quite varying skill levels within our same session, but it was still tailored to us. So looking at accessibility as a topic, in 2014, Ofsted conducted some research into the number of English competitors in the 2012 Olympics who had been educated in independent schools. The study found that despite fewer than 1 in 10 pupils attending a fee-paying school, more than 4 in 10 of the British athletes who won medals at London 2012 were schooled privately. You know, independent schools produce a far greater number of sporting stars than state schools for various reasons. But one factor is that independent schools are often able to separate responsibility for teaching PE and coaching, which gives both PE teachers and coaches the time to do both and to do both well. Netball, I think you could argue, it's been known historically to be somewhat of an elitist sport, and money will always be a factor in this. But what do you think could be done to close the gap and level the playing field?
Such an important bit of information you've picked up there. And you know, that stat stays consistent at the last two Olympic Games. And you're exactly right. It's exposure to better coaches, specialist coaches at a young age, that give you the skills early on to go and be a better athlete. And whilst early specialization, if your listeners are familiar with this term, which means getting into a sport, you know, at the earliest possible age, isn't the way to have a long and successful and healthy career in a sport. You want to have a variety of experiences early on. But the higher quality training that you can consume and be a part of early on has a massive impact in your ability to make it into, you know, whether it be elite sport or just participate, because, you know, you get better training. So our goal is to make training more available to more people and the people who probably need it most. You know, I've actually set up a social enterprise on the side to try and address some of this. And, you know, what I'm trying to do in my space is get high quality strength and conditioning into UK state schools that PE teachers can run. And PE teachers, as you may know, as part of their formal education, they don't go through any extensive work into what good physical preparation looks like and good strength and conditioning looks like for young people. You know, they cover fitness, but then they don't really cover the detail that's required to develop young bodies to give them the most possible options to go into sport, whether that's like an elite level like you described or just to participate. So what I'm trying to do through my social enterprise is give teachers the skills to systemize and program training within schools. And, you know, whether it's through what I'm trying to do or any other space, the more knowledge we can give our teachers, and whether that's the PE teacher or the geography teacher, right? Because as you know, the maths or geography teacher might be leading PE in that particular school. The more they understand about how to systemize it, how to look at a young person and figure out what they need to do, then the better they're going to be able to build young bodies that can, you know, have the physical literacy. That's what we call it, the physical literacy to go into the wide world and use those skills to do whatever they want to do, then that's for the better.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you just think about the number of kids in state schools who might not have a great experience within PE or within extracurricular sports, like, think of the number of future Serena Guthries or Joe Hartons that we might be missing out on in the UK because of the differences in physical education between independent and state schools. Like, it's absolutely heartbreaking.
100%, 100%, and we'll never know.
Yeah,
but whilst I say we never know, we also do know that they're out there. And, you know, even though within players who are involved in franchises and pathways, you know, there's a high dropout rate at every level just because, you know, life and careers and unis and all the other things you could do. And we got to work very hard, you know, at whatever level we're in to retain players, because, you know, you might not have made it at 18 years old, but maybe you'll make it at 22, 24, maybe even later. Of course, you know, people tend to drop out before then, but who knows, maybe in your late 20s, that was the moment where everything just clicked. And if you'd made it that far, then, you know, a career could have emerged. Look, the other thing we're up against in netball is it just doesn't pay the bills in the same way that a professional career in other sports does, or just in other professional industries. So we're always going to be fighting to keep players involved and, you know, training their hardest and recovering at the level they need to do to stay in the sport for longer and achieve more.
Yeah, definitely. And that idea of, you know, maybe reaching your professional peak at a later stage. You know, our previous episode of Sulu Fitzpatrick, she had her first cap at 19 and then her second cap 7 years later. So, you know, that there are, and I think Claire Kirsten as well, she came back into silver fern. She's sort of later 20s. So just because you haven't hit that elite level at 18, 19, 20, you know, whatever, doesn't mean that you won't.
100%. You know, the other thing to remember is you don't always have to travel up. You know, you don't always have to move, you know, from, you know, a club player to an international player. It's also a perfectly fine pathway to be a young international and go on to have a really strong club career. And that's by no means a failure. You know, it's not moving up and down. It's just following your own path. And, you know, going back to what you said before about having an environment that's based around a growth mindset, you know, as long as you feel like you're getting better every day, that should be the main driver to keep you involved, whether you are selected for England or whatnot. It actually doesn't matter.
100%. And I think that's so important in grassroots, that is, you don't have to play sport or to play netball to become an international. You do it for you.
Yeah. And there's actually a cool piece of research, if you're into this stuff, which talks about people's involvement in sport existing in three worlds. And the top world is in fact, I've kind of done it a disservice by calling it the top world, but one of the worlds is called the elite world. Mm. And in that world, you're referencing your performance against elite standards. A world next to that is a world where you want to compete every day or whenever you're playing, but you're not necessarily comparing yourself to elite standards. So that's the, you know, the netballer who turns up on the weekend and just wants to, you know, go to war against whoever they're playing, but, you know, win or lose, you know, why should feel it at the moment, it doesn't really matter. And then the other world is that people who are in it just to participate and have fun. And, you know, again, going back to what I said before, you don't have to always feel like you're climbing up those worlds. Mm. It's perfectly fine to exist in whatever world you want to be in. And maybe you were in that elite world to start with, and now you've ended up in the participation world. That's cool. Yeah. You know, enjoy the game, enjoy the sport, enjoy your strength and conditioning, get fit, and that's fine. Yeah. And actually, even within the Super League, there are players who are in the elite space, but their headspace isn't in the elite world. And you might feel as a trainer that it's your job to bring them to that world. And of course, you want to push them to where you feel they've fulfilled their potential. But look, if they're, you know, the 12th person on the roster, they're being paid, you know, a very low salary each year. They have a full-time job elsewhere. Whilst, you know, when they're at training, they want to be the best they can be. You can't expect them to have all the behaviors that the elite world would have. And I've come to realize that's okay. You know, if you asked more of them, that wouldn't fully understand where they are as a player in their career right now and what they can really give to the sport.
Love that. All about the individual. That's brilliant.
And I suppose as well that the benefits of working on your strength and conditioning and being fit and being strong, they translate so much further than just on the netball court, you know, just your participation in life and, you know, being able to be active and do other sports and transfer those fitness skills that you've had as well is also really important.
Yeah, and I've been doing these coach education sessions for, you know, teams around the country. And one of the first things we talk about are what are the aims of strength and conditioning? And how does that change at different age groups? So look, with the Super League, we're in the business of results. We're in the business of improving our athleticism to help the game and handle the demands of the game better, like we've talked about. But my question to coaches working with younger athletes, is it that same purpose you're trying to work towards? And should part of your strength and conditioning be about giving young people transferable fitness skills, trying to give them fitness qualities that they can take into the rest of their life, you know? And the answer is probably yes, it's more about those things. And then the other thing with strength and conditioning is that it's just this great framework to talk about cool stuff in life, you know? You know, throw in your, you know, your life lessons. And like I said before, I'm a big Rocky fan. And, you know, if you watch the Rocky movie, it's all about life lessons through boxing, right? So, yeah. You know, if you want to be that style of coach, you can throw all that stuff in there to try and give them something to take away far beyond the netball court. And that stuff's really, really important.
Yeah, I'm 100% certain that we had the Rocky tune in our training sessions, actually. You just reminded me. I'm sure that sneaked in there. So just to wrap up, because I'm aware we've taken quite a lot of your time, we want to look at the future of strength and conditioning in netball. So the physicality of VNSL has been spoken about a lot, and, you know, we've already mentioned it in this week's episode. And having watched the first round of the ANZ at the weekend, and with SSN starting imminently, you can definitely see that the physicality of the game is on an upward trajectory. So if you were one of the netball gods, what changes would you make within strength and conditioning in netball?
Number one thing is create professional netballers who can train more and recover more. You know, we're not limited right now by knowledge, you know, as a profession. We're not limited in our sport by the degree to which the coaches are brought in, but we're massively limited for some players in terms of the amount of time they have to train and recover. Mm. And, you know, the reality is it comes down to the dollars and pounds, and players are always going to, you know, try and pay the mortgage and have a career, as they should, you know, do that stuff outside of netball. But with more time, you know, we can create more athletic bodies. And actually, probably the piece that is missed, we probably have, you know, most of the athletic qualities we're ever going to have in the sport. But are we giving the players enough time to prepare themselves to handle the demands of the game? And we started by talking about how intense netball is as a sport and how intense international competitions are, especially. And, you know, the reality is more time to train is more time to prepare for those demands.
The potential of what could be if we were fully professional. I love it. Well, thank you so much, Dan. It's been so insightful, so interesting to hear about this. That's something that I don't think gets talked about a lot. So thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, thank you so much for having me and for a podcast to have a strength and conditioning coach on early, you know, in its life is so super cool. So thank you so much from the profession, not just.
Well, we think it's really important. So yeah, absolute joy to have you on.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to episode 11 of Quarter Time. We cannot wait to bring you more netball chat and another awesome guest next week.
Make sure you subscribe to the podcast and follow us on social media at Quarter Time Pod for the latest netball updates. We are back into the Super League this week, so get involved in the conversation online by tagging us in your three-word summaries of the games and letting us know which players have stood out for you each week using the story template in our Instagram highlights.
Enjoy round 12 and see you next week. Bye!